Timeless presents, Should You Freeze Your Eggs? Egg freezing for lifestyle as opposed to medical reasons is growing at pace in the UK. Does it provide women with more control over their reproductive futures? Or is it an oversold scam? And if you are considering freezing your eggs, where would you even start? In this talk, we cut through some of the confusion and misinformation that surrounds egg freezing and look frankly at the pros and cons from a medical, social, and personal perspective. With panelists Emily Jackson, Professor of Law at the London School of Economics and Political Science, Dr. Yaqub Khalif, Medical Director of the Assisted Conception Unit at Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital, Dr. Francoise Shenfield, Infertility Specialist at University College London Hospital, and Helen Johnson, founder of the goddess Acumen, who had her eggs frozen last year. The panel is chaired by Sarah Norcross, Director of Progress Educational Trust. Timeless presents, Should You Freeze Your Eggs?
Welcome to this. I'm Sarah Norcross, and I'm the Director of the Progress Educational Trust. And we're a charity that does a lot of public engagement work and policy work in this area, so around assisted conception and genetics and stem cell and embryo research. And this is an area that we've been thinking about as a charity for quite a long time now. It's probably, I can see Evan Harris is in the audience, and he'll remember that when the human fertilisation embryology bill was going through Parliament in 2007-8, we were trying to get the amount of time that women could freeze their eggs extended for longer, but the government in their wisdom just decided 10 years for no rhyme nor reason, no logical reason, just because they were a bit uncomfortable about women freezing their eggs when there wasn't a medical reason. So we, Evan and I, despite our combined powers of persuasion, failed to be able to even think any differently. So, egg freezing has been having a real, well, I was going to call it a moment, but it's actually gone on, it's a moment that's gone on now over several years with sort of Apple and, well, Google and Facebook. And then just a couple of weeks ago, the US military said that they were going to introduce a pilot scheme for egg freezing for their personnel. At first I thought this was fantastic, you know, this is for women who were going off to the front or going to Iraq and, you know, IEDs and something. You know, I was just trying to help think how it would work, because it's quite common for sperm donation in those sorts of, freezing sperm in those scenarios. But this was because they've got a retention, because they've got a problem with retaining female members of staff, so it's coming in with a whole range of things like lactation rooms and more family-friendly policies. So anyway, we shall see what they do at the Pentagon and whether we can learn anything from them. So there are going to be, I think, lots of interesting issues tonight. We have about an hour. If we get carried away, we can stay in here a bit longer. But I'm not going to continue to talk much longer. We're going to have each of the panels speak in turn. And then at the end, we'll have a general discussion. If you want to introduce yourself when we're having that discussion, please do. If you'd rather not, then that's fine too. We won't press you. So, the first speaker this evening is going to be Yaqub Khalif, who is a clinician and consultant at the Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital in their assisted conception unit. Yaqub is the director of the pre-implantation and genetic diagnosis program there, and he's also a member of the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority. So, Yaqub, you've got 5 minutes, and I'm putting my timer on so it will start making noises.
Thank you very much, Sarah. I don't know how long is 5 minutes, but I will try.
Okay.
I think my brief is to avoid as much as possible overlap with other speakers. I've no idea what other speakers will say, so you can imagine. I would start by just addressing the well-known facts about biology, but one of the well-known facts is that women are from Venus. And because of this, metaphorically speaking, the biology is slightly different. Whilst men will go on to produce sperm until eventually the end of life, for women, they are born with a finite number of eggs, and at the moment a girl is born will be endowed with about 7 million with about 2 million eggs, but the maximum number of eggs is reached when that girl was 20 weeks inside her mother's womb. By the time this girl reached puberty and start her first period, how many eggs do you think will have been left in that reserve? Any idea? Just have a guess.
500,000.
Oh, you are obviously doing your homework. Okay, so it is 500,000. And that 500,000 will still take on the decline. That decline will be very gradual and slow at the early part of reproductive life. But come age 35, this decline will be gathering some pace. But it will be a bit steeper beyond the age of 38. So by the time it is 45, 46, then the number of functional eggs that can lead to healthy pregnancy become very few and far between. So these are the facts. When we stimulate a woman's ovary, if they choose to go for egg freezing, or when they go through IVF, even in a standard way, we aim to get as many eggs as safely possible in one round. And the average will be, say, 15, maybe in the context of egg freezing, maybe 15 to 20. If the woman chooses to have 3 rounds of ovarian stimulation and egg extraction for egg freezing, it means that she has lost from her endowment 60 eggs, but she has not lost them in another sense because they will be going on ice. But the question that usually get asked, does this mean that the woman has lost 60 months of her reproductive age because every month normally she produces only one egg, while in these 3 rounds happening over 3 months, she will have 60 eggs taken out? The simple answer, it does not make any difference at all, because when we stimulate the ovaries, we are rescuing the other follicle that would have been would have died in the process only to nurture one follicle that lead to the egg that will be released at the time of ovulation. So whether patients are having ovarian stimulation for IVF or for egg freezing, they should not worry that they will be at risk of early menopause. Moving on to the technology, a few years back, talking about egg freezing would not have been the most favorite subject for us because it is something that we would face the huge limitation of the technology. You freeze the eggs, they don't survive freezing, the potential of giving rise to a baby is so limited, or was so limited indeed, until that very clever technique of freezing eggs in a very rapid way, so-called flash freezing or vitrification, meant that eggs can survive and can survive the freezing well, and figures of 90% of those eggs surviving freezing is not uncommon and can be achieved. However, the age at which the freezing of eggs is performed is important to the overall outcome, because the best age is probably around the 30th somehow, but if one has to find themselves faced with the prospect of freezing at the age of 40 or beyond, really the outlook is not great, because you're freezing eggs that they do not have the same quality as younger eggs, and I'm sure Francoise will be covering the results in terms of the chance of giving rise to a baby. The choice as to freeze eggs or not to freeze eggs, from my experience, is totally and utterly individual, because it is not governed or controlled by what you hear about statistics. It's about you weighing the ups and downs in your own personal profile and your circumstances, your projections, your commitment, and you make that choice. So it is our duty just to provide you with facts and figures to facilitate making that informed choice. And before being shot down by Sarah, it is really important message that I feel that I'm preaching to the converted, because you are here because you know enough about the subject, but there are so many women out there that they think just because one is taking the pill for contraception, there is no ovulation, the eggs are stored in a timeless way. That is not true. So with this quick whistle stop tour in the main facts, I have to shut up. Thank you.
Thank you, Yaki. Yeah. You've set a very bad precedent now for the rest of them, and also shown my poor time management skills. So next up, we have Dr. Françoise Shenfield. Now, Françoise is a specialist, a fertility specialist at University College London. But Françoise is a woman of many talents. She wasn't satisfied with just medicine. She's also done qualifications in medical law and ethics. So Françoise, I shall hand over to you now.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for setting the scene. You talked about a few important things. Obviously, age, information, and we've got a law specialist after us. If we get consent as a doctor from you, the key to consent is to give you the information. So what we, some of us feel is sometimes the information out there is not really good enough. And of course, if you go and consult, it's our duty to give you proper information in understandable terms which fit your case. And I have a hobby horse. I think these things should be introduced at school and then repeated at university, and then you can then make informed choice, because it's very difficult for a woman. Times have changed so much. When I started my medical studies, we might have been 20% as women of our medical students. Now we have to fight hard not to have more women than men to keep it equal. It's at least 50%. So the scene has completely changed for us women. Many of them of us study more and more. And what I tell my medical students when I give a lecture is that it will never be the right time. It will never be convenient. Forget about convenient. If you're sure you want to have a baby, try to think about it in your early 30s. Dylan said, in your late 20s, because they would completely freak out. But this is a biological fact, as you're pointing out, which cannot be changed. So I think egg freezing is the beginning of equality, but you are, rather than me, the younger amongst you, the experimental generation, because we're learning more and more. And the first group who's done a lot of research on that first, where the master at vitrification, which, as you said, has changed the scenes. 5-6 years ago, we were egg freezing, forget it. Embryo freezing, yes, but you need to have a partner to freeze embryo. So most women who are now looking for egg freezing, we know from some research, are women in their mid to late 30s who haven't found the right person, because life is busy. And for the men in this audience, I think you also should be aware of the time bomb that women undergo, because for you it's completely different. That's why I think it should be taught at school, so that we all integrate this. So the Spanish have shown, and they are the ones which in Europe and probably in the world have the most data, because they've been doing that a lot and doing egg freezing for egg donation as well. They've shown that if you freeze before 35 and after 35, roughly, to sum up, for the same amount of frozen eggs, the success rate in what's called cumulative live birth rate, using all your eggs, is half. Of course, as I tell my patient, nothing dreadful is going to happen on the day you turn 35. Every one of us is different, and some 37-year-old lady will have the biology of a 32, and sadly also the other way around, because it's, you know, that Gaussian curve of a normality, and some of us have to be at the end of it and be slightly different. So I think maybe it's not quite my 5 minutes, but I think that's enough to give you a sense of what I want to say. You need information. It seems to be safe for the offspring. Top of the concerns of women who do this, and the major studies have come from Belgium. Am I going to put my health at risk, or am I going to put my future offsprings at risk? We have no evidence that either is harmful to a person who does it or to the babies born from it. So that's very important and quite reassuring. Of course, the more data we have, the more we'll be able to be sure about that. But nowadays, there's no really very little risk of hyperstimulating women thanks to the drugs we use, which was one of the risks of IVF always, and that's going down. Thankfully, well, it should be extremely rare. So it's pretty safe. So, you know, it's not particularly fun, but you know, I know no woman who comes to Dr. Abudi is my smear day today. We do it. We go to a dentist, we have our smear done, so it's a bit more than that. But if you're motivated, it's not that difficult a procedure, but it must be tailored to your need and seen as an insurance. Now, if we sign an insurance paper for a fire, we don't partly want to have fire in our home. And most women who do that don't partly want to use them, but they keep it as a kind of insurance for if, let's say at 42, they haven't met the person with whom they want, or they met him a bit later. And probably also what's got to be thought about is how long you think you want to be able to use them. I myself would be for a limit, I have to say, not use them later than 50, and I would prefer 45, because my colleague obstetrician know that pregnancy gets more complicated with age. And I also think psychologically it may be a burden to think that you have something in the bank that you can use till you're 75. No, it shouldn't be seen like that, because that's unreasonable. So I'll stop here.
Thank you very much, Françoise. So our next speaker is taking a completely different tack now, because we have Helen Johnson. Helen is the founder of a personal development company called Acumen Goddess. She has a PhD in criminology, and she has done what some may have done in the room, but I don't think anyone on the panel has done, and she has frozen her eggs. So, Helen, you can tell us what it's like from the cold face, perhaps.
Yeah, well, the question that I was asked was, should you freeze your eggs? So I thought, what advice would I give to people that are thinking about it? And I think the first point is, yes, I have a brain. And what I found is that when I was trying to think about this, that a lot of people kind of questioned my ability to make a decision around this. So what I would say to anyone is, ladies, I trust you. You can make a decision. You can think, you can weigh these things up yourselves. You know how to access the kind of inner wisdom and to find that answer yourselves. So a lot of the time, even the advice we get, I actually got negative advice, don't do it, based on fear-mongering. Kind of the assumption is that you're so afraid that you're making a silly decision because you're afraid of your future. I found it the other way, that people tried to make me afraid to not do it. And I had quite a kind of clear reasons why I wanted to do it. So you're capable of making decisions, I know this. And I think that's really important, because you can kind of doubt yourself when all the information is coming at you from all directions. And that's my second point, really, which is that the most important thing is, instead of talking to women about how they're incapable of making these decisions because it's so emotive, is to actually make sure that we have the right information, that we're perfectly capable of weighing up. And actually, the point is, it is an emotive issue. It's a deeply personal, deeply emotional issue. And guess what? Your emotions are communicative. They're telling you something, and you can listen to your emotions. That's okay. You don't have to ignore them. It's not the same as being kind of overtaken by panic when panic's in the driver's seat, to actually kind of listen to yourself. And I think as women, we're told a lot that our emotions mean that we can't kind of think clearly. I don't know if you find that, but I certainly do. But I would say that my kind of experience of egg freezing was deeply emotional. So the physical side wasn't really an issue for me. I didn't find it kind of too difficult. It was fine. It wasn't great, but it was fine. But it was the vulnerability, the standing here, you know, looking at these bottles here and just realizing that you don't actually have control, and to admit your vulnerability in that area, especially when, for me, it's because I haven't found a partner. So, you know, everything's kind of out of your control then, and that was hard. And the other thing that I found really difficult was having to kind of stand up and say, yeah, this is something I really, really want. In a society where when you're single and you're a woman of a certain age, you're also told that men won't want to date you if you really want a child, and your work will find you kind of unattractive, and they might even try to force you to egg freeze because they don't like fertile women, right? They don't like women going off and becoming mothers. So it's kind of hard to stand up and say, I really deeply want this, and I acknowledge that it might not be possible in the way I want it. The other thing is that some people assumed I was giving up. Believe me, I did not give up, and I have not had a drought in the last year. I did it a year ago, and it's all been fine, thank you very much. You know, I carried on dating, and you know, I'm still optimistic in that area. And there's a kind of thought that maybe you're manifesting something kind of bad, that it's almost like you're saying that it's not going to happen for you. And I think it's the opposite. I think you're kind of saying, all right, universe, I'll cooperate with you for a start. And also, the best piece of advice I got, and it's something that I'm doing in my work at the moment, kind of promoting, is if you want to be a mother, then actually the way to manifest that is the two things that are about motherhood and fertility. One is creativity. Create things, nurture, build new life in other areas. And the second is to nurture yourself and be your own loving mother, be the mother you want to be to you. And so if you're, yeah, if you're kind of worried that it's giving up, actually become your own loving mother and then make the decisions about egg freezing based on what's right or wrong for you. That's what I would say. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Helen. That's really interesting. So I'm just trying to now stop the timer, otherwise it'll tell while I'm introducing Emily. So our final speaker this evening is Professor Emily Jackson. Emily is a professor of law at the LSE. She's written many books on medical law and ethics. In fact, when we have students in our office and they get to meet Emily, we have known them to actually bring their textbooks in for her to autograph. She's that beloved in that field. But Emily also was deputy chair of the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority for many years. She's now got time off for good behaviour from them. And so she's going to talk to us about the law and some of the ethical issues surrounding egg freezing. So, Emily.
Thanks, Sarah. And thank you all for coming. And it was great talks to jump off from, especially what Helen just said, which I think is really interesting about this is up to women, and of course it is. So the reasons women often give for freezing their eggs is that it keeps options open, that it relieves a degree of pressure that people might feel, that pressure on relationships. And the metaphor Francois used was one of insurance. And I think insurance is an interesting one because this is a pretty expensive insurance policy. It's not cheap. So if you think about an insurance policy which costs you £4,000 and which the odds are you won't use it and that it might not work at all because there are no guarantees with IVF. Because obviously once you've frozen your eggs, if you do use them, you'll have to use IVF, and IVF doesn't work 100% of the time. So there are no guarantees that this will work, and so some people have suggested that actually the better metaphor, this isn't quite perfect as well, isn't insurance, but is a lottery ticket, that you're buying chance. The odds are a bit better than the National Lottery, obviously.
Yes.
More of a raffle, then, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Something like that. One of the things that I think is quite interesting about what the insurance might be for here, though, is that I think from the interviews we've seen of people who have frozen their eggs, is that what people might be insuring against is future regret, worrying that in the future, if you find yourself facing difficulty in having a child, possibly the need to use donor eggs, and you had the option of egg freezing and didn't take it, are you going to regret that? And so you're actually insuring against future regret, and I think that worries me a little bit. In the sense that is that going to mean in the future, obviously this is very new technology, but in the future women might find themselves blaming themselves for their future infertility or even being blamed, and that's quite a scary thought. Certainly when I think about this, I don't know what I'd do if I was young enough for this to be an option. I think it would worry me that I might regret not doing it, but on the other hand, as Helen says, you've got to go into this with your eyes open. There's also a huge ambiguity about when to freeze your eggs, because it's most likely to work if you're quite young. But also, if you do it when you're quite young, say late 20s, you're actually overwhelmingly not likely to use them because you're likely to conceive naturally. So it's likely to have been a massive waste of money if you do it when you're quite young. Also, in this country, as Sarah mentioned, there's a statutory storage period. So you've only, unless you're prematurely infertile, got 10 years. So there's a scenario in which you freeze your eggs at 25, at 35 they have to be destroyed, and then you find yourself needing donor eggs anyway, having gone through this. So the statutory storage period means that actually doing it when it's most likely to work, you're not likely to use them, and they might actually be legally unusable. If you freeze your eggs when you're older, say after 37, you're more likely to use them, but it's less likely to work. So can you see how these are really complex odds to balance? This is an expensive intervention, and these are difficult odds to judge against each other. Finally, I think there's just wanted to mention some tensions that I think there are with this technology. on the one hand, you could say, well, this is entirely liberating for women. That in a sense, this is a bit like the contraceptive pill, in the sense that it liberates women from the constraints of their reproductive biology. You don't need to worry if you've got your eggs frozen that your time is running out and the clock is ticking. That it also, in that sort of similar vein, you might say, it equalises to an extent, potentially, the position of career-driven, ambitious men and women in their 20s and 30s, where you, if this does become routine, women could feel that they could establish themselves and get themselves settled in their career before they worry about children in the same way that men can. So on the one hand, you could say, well, this is potentially hugely liberating. At the same time, you could say, well, it individualises and medicalises a collective social problem, which is the gap, graphically illustrated here, between women's peak fertility, the peak time for conceiving, and when women actually feel ready to have a baby in terms of finding the right partner, having themselves established in their career, having a secure and settled life. So there's a mismatch there, and you could say that egg freezing isn't the solution to that. That's putting all of the responsibility here on individual women, rather than saying we need to make it easier for people to have kids when they're younger, and we need more family-friendly workplaces. So you could say it individualises that problem. I also think there's another way in which you could say this is medicalisation, and that's this, that infertility treatment, as anyone who in this room has gone through it will know, is grueling, stressful, emotional, and women generally only do it when they absolutely have to. Egg freezing, one more second, egg freezing potentially makes all premenopausal women potential consumers or customers of fertility treatment. So far from being something you can only sell to people who actually want to have a baby then and there, this is something you can sell much more broadly. And I think that brings you on to the idea that clinics mustn't oversell this. It's important that people go into it, as Helen said, with their eyes open. They need to know the risks. They need to know that it won't necessarily provide any guarantees. And finally, I think one thing that's really important is that women aren't lulled into a false sense of security by having done this, thinking, my fertility is on ice, I don't need to worry. Because there's then a danger that you might delay childbearing even more, thus actually, ironically, increasing the likelihood of future childlessness. So as long as people have all the information they need, it's up to obviously individual women, but it's really important that clinics give them honest, frank, brutally frank perhaps, information in order to make this choice.
Thank you very much, Emily. So, who's got the first question, or shall I leap in with my question? One thing that I really think is important, and this is one for the clinicians really, is how, with our knowledge at the moment, you know, how successful is freezing eggs likely to be if you need to use them in within the statutory time limit? So say you get them frozen when you're 32, then, you know, what are the odds if I'm buying my raffle ticket, buy a book?
Yeah, the odds, according to Anna Kobo and, one of the most famous scientists in the field, the latest publication, it really depends on your age. Again, I said don't freak out if you're over 35, but they did their sample and they, for analysis below and over. So if you look, let's say you've frozen 8 eggs below 35, you have a 40% chance of having a pregnancy. If you are over 35, this is 99.9, i.e. half, 20%. And this goes for all ages with all numbers. If you freeze 15 eggs, that gives you below 35 an 85% chance of having a live birth, because of course, pregnancy, miscarriages and so on also go up, the miscarriage rate with the age of our eggs. And if you are over 36 and if you freeze 11, and it's interesting that the data is at 11, because I suspect they had very few women able to freeze more than that, you freeze 11, you've got a 35% chance of a live birth rate. So these are, all the time we're getting more and more data, which we didn't have even 4 or 5 years ago.
If you could tell them to answer that, Yaku.
Yeah, I think it's important to just have kind of a note of caution here. Whenever we quote figures from the best centers.
Sure.
The ones with high experience, long experience, and they can get the best survival and the best result. it's important when you consider this and go to a particular clinic to ask for that particular clinic information. What is so compounding here that not many clinics in the UK will be able to give you data for the chances of having a baby from using frozen eggs for fertility preservation under those circumstances. What they could have as a surrogate is the circumstances where they had to freeze eggs for a couple because the sperm was not available on the day, and then they replaced them later and resulted in pregnancy or an alive birth. So it's important to bear this in mind, because I think the majority of clinics in the UK will not be able to provide meaningful live birth statistics for like was like, and that is important.
So there's a question in the middle.
Yes, thank you. I actually had a question for you, about the statutory period, the 10-year period. You mentioned in the beginning that
yes.
you had discussions about that in the past.
Mm.
Could you elaborate a little bit more about those discussions, what, on what terms they were made, and also whether there is a case for revisiting that time limit given the developments that have happened in relation to egg freezing?
Yeah, well, I think, well, Evan, feel free to chip in, because your memory might of this might be better than mine, but during the passage of the legislation through Parliament, there were a series of regular meetings discussing, because it was a lot of changes were going through, so it was looking at all these different changes and evaluating whether we thought they were good policy or not. And with this, it was something that was being sort of improved and formalised really in that legislation, and there was a lot of talk about how long people could store embryos for and gametes, and there was the difficulty is because biology discriminates between the sexes, was then trying to sort of make sure that I think the government and the Department of Health were sort of bending over to try and make sure that they weren't falling foul of any discriminatory legislation. But we're adopting quite a cautious position in terms of social freezing. I think that's Evan.
I think there was a double standard at play.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because
I think
a 70-year-old man has a kid, good guy,
yeah.
you know, plenty of lead in your pencil. Yeah. If a 55-year-old with technology, a woman, has a child, then this is outrageous. And you get, and the government at the time probably still was terrified of passing legislation that was not particularly liberal, because it still ends up being an informed consent question for the patient and the ethical practice of a doctor who's not going to replace an embryo in a 75-year-old. It just wouldn't be ethical. But instead of leaving it to informed people, women who can make decisions, has been said, and doctors who have ethical obligations to put the clinical interest, best interests of the patient first, they said, we don't want the Daily Mail headline. And I could not extract from them a rational reason for, and as Emily says, there's this conundrum that the more effective it is, you create a barrier for their use because of this 10-year rule. And there's no such rule on effective reproductive age for men. So it was indefensible in my view, and it was one of many battles we lost in that bill, as I recall.
Can I ask a question from you and our legal experts? Because if I sign as a clinician that after 10 years, in my clinical opinion, there would be a danger to the fertility of that patient, then I can sign the continuation of the freezing, and I do that routinely for men who stored in our lab because they've had cancer. Can't I do that for a woman as well? Let's say she's 37. In my clinical opinion, I've done the AMH and the antral follicle count. She's in danger of losing her fertility.
So
that it wouldn't be dishonest. To my mind, it would be ethical. Would it be illegal?
So what you would have to certify is that the patient was or was likely to become prematurely infertile.
Yeah.
And so if you had somebody who had very low ovarian reserve and you thought actually there was a chance that she was going to become prematurely infertile, then you could certify that. But if it was just a woman facing normal age-related fertility decline, that's not prematurely infertile, and so you would be unable legally to certify that she was prematurely infertile, which is why you can do that with patients with cancer treatment where it is premature infertility. Just on Evan's point, I think one of, I've just got back, which is why I might be a bit hazy from Australia, so I'm massively jet lagged, but they don't have this rule there, so I was talking about this over there. There's no statutory screening period. So it's not as though this is something you absolutely have to have. They have very well regulated system over there, but there isn't a statutory storage limit, and they were quite surprised when I was going on about 10 years. They were, what on earth is that for? And I think the reason why there was a statutory storage limit, and initially it was 5 years, the reason why there was a statutory storage limit to begin with, and when this was drafted in the late 1980s, was this worry that if you didn't have some sort of time limit, clinics would just get fuller and fuller and fuller of people's embryos and sperm, and they needed a way to be able to force people to make decisions about what they wanted to do with them by pointing to this statute. But I think that's, now that just seems absurd. So, I mean, I would have thought there has to be pressure for the law to change on this. It doesn't make any sense.
And where can it be revised?
You need a government willing to do that, and I'm not sure we've got that at the moment.
The government doesn't want to open up the bill for further amendments, even if they agreed with that, because we don't get me started.
But it usually ends up reopening the abortion debate.
I wanted to pick up on Jakub's point about the success data for the particular clinic you're using. Is there a big variation, and what drives that variation?
Like every treatment, there will be some variation depending on the skills of the operator, and it sounds like very easy, we are putting the egg on ice. It is not. The way you do it, the amount of cryoprotectant that you use, the protocol you are using, the experience you have, it is bound to have variation from one place to another.
If I can add something to that, you know, we have evidence in many fields of medicine.
Yeah.
The more you do one thing, the better you get at it. This is why if a child has cystic fibrosis, for instance, we know that he or she will have much better treatment if they go to a specialist center, just because we keep up with the latest. And if you do just, in IVF it's the same, if the clinic did 50 or 100 cycles a year, I'm not sure that they're as experienced as somebody who does 500 to 1,000. And there's that experience, and an excellent lab. These are really the...
So it's really important to compare the overall numbers that they're doing, not just percentages.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
you know, they might only do five, and they've been lucky.
Yeah.
So you've got 100% success. So you've got to weigh that into the equation. So the lady here in the white...
Surely at the moment you can't really say how successful one clinic is from another, seeing as that this process has only been going on for, say, 6 years, you've said.
You can get an indication. I can only suggest that if the unit is successful in the general IVF program, it means that the decision making, the quality control in the lab, the way things are done are delivering what has been promised. And that
IVF as a whole.
Yeah. And also, it is perfectly legitimate to ask this particular clinic, how many eggs so far you have frozen, and how many you have thawed, and what is the survival rate as an indication. And if they had pregnancies, it would help to share with you how many they had, out of how many cycles they warmed the eggs or thawed them.
How easy is that information?
Oh, no, I think decent clinics should have this information. As little or as much as it is, they will share it with the patient to enable important decision to be made.
Do you think there are barriers, though? Do you think that people are that open with their clinics?
I think today, actually, interestingly, we're having a discussion with the HFA, because the HFA, I'm informed, they would be publishing data about the egg freezing in this country and the outcome. Yes. The only thing is, they don't have distinction between the old method or the new method. That's just, but moving forward, they will make that distinction. So it could be slightly misleading. It would be helpful, as I suggested, to expect the clinics to audit their egg survival after freezing so that it is an indication of how well the process is being conducted.
Yeah, Cube, do they also have a distinction between freezing from looking sort of historically when women were doing it more for medical reasons? Do they have Do they have that distinction? Because I think that might be, it would seem to be as a non-memory, an important distinction.
Yes.
If you're using it, from someone who's had a serious disease, it might be less successful than from a fit one.
You can get that with a Freedom of Information request, because I've been trying to get this kind of data for several countries in Europe. So it's just starting, because we need to know medical indication, and of course some of these women will be just prior to treatment for breast cancer or whatever, they won't be in a particularly very healthy state, and some it will affect their health and some it won't affect their health. So we're kind of in a transition phase, and it's always difficult to be in a transition phase, but historically I think everybody has been in a transition phase for something. So that's how it is. So what we need is medical reason and non-medical reason. And medical reason also subdivided into serious disease, like cancer or endometriosis would be another reason. Women who, it's known, are at risk of a more rapidly decreasing ovarian reserve. And from the small data that we have with my European collaborators, they are different. The number of eggs you get on average if somebody is going through ART freezing or through cancer or for non-medical reason is slightly different.
And can I just say as well, like my experience of that is I was lucky, I knew a really kind of top medical professional who recommended like the best place to go basically. I knew I was well looked after, and in those consultations I was given like all of that information. But when I had, you have to have STD screening and you have to be signed off, and when I went for that, it was just around the road from the clinic, and it had been recommended as a great STD place, but the woman said, why are you here? And I said, oh, I'm having my eggs frozen. And she just was like, it's bullshit. You need fertilized eggs. Like, what are you doing? It's just because you're a vulnerable woman. And, because obviously I must be an idiot and over emotional. And I was just like, wow. And because I knew, like, the woman that had recommended this thing to me, I've had a long-standing medical relationship with, and she's like, amazing. And she was like, go to these people, they're amazing. So I knew I was well looked after, but actually it was like this misinformation as well by someone who didn't know anything about the new science. She was kind of like throwing things at me, but there are really strong, excellent clinics out there and they will give you that information. But yeah, quality is important in terms of where you go.
Okay, lady in the middle,
I'm really keen to know, say you go through the process and you freeze your eggs.
Just speak up slightly, it's more leaning forward, back to here.
So you go through the process of freezing your eggs and you hit hard times and you can't make the payments to store the eggs. What happens then? Who owns your eggs?
Should we pass that to the lawyer first? Yes. Or the clinicians who will...
Who've got the freezers.
So the ownership is complicated here. There is a court case in which a court decided that men owned their sperm samples when they were in storage. It was a case in which the sperm samples had become compromised because something had gone wrong with the storage. And they wanted to sue the clinic. And so the judges were trying to find a way for them to do that, and they were able to do that by saying they have property rights in their stored sperm. So you could draw an analogy there and say you have property rights in your eggs, and I think there's certainly rights which are very similar to property rights in the sense of the right to control them. I think that it's a really important question. What if you can't pay the storage fee? It's about £300 a year. And clinics ought to have some mechanism in place to be able to say to people, well, we won't charge you, but we'll charge you in the future, because destroying your eggs because you can't pay £300 would be gruesome. It would be really gruesome.
My experience was that I got options. Would, in general, if you don't use your eggs, do you want them put to science? Do you want them destroyed? Will you donate them? Blah, 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 blah. And I'm pretty sure you make that option and they check with you again in the future. But I definitely know that I was asked, like, could you do with them? This,
no,
so it's a contract. Payment.
No, this is, well, it's actually, it's in the HFEA. And if gametes or embryo, which is kept, and I'm a past member, but you have to say, in case I die or become mentally incapacitated, which is I cannot give consent anymore, I want my gametes, eggs or sperm, or my embryos to be discarded or given to research, or in case of eggs or sperm equality given to a named partner. It has to be a named partner for possible use. But I'm biased. I'm very privileged. I've always worked in the National Health Service. So, my, you know, my dream would be that the question of money would not happen. And some colleagues of ours, Belgium ethicist, writing about it, has made the case that actually it might, we don't know, it might save the NHS money. Let's say you are 29, you come and freeze your eggs. And yes, you need IVF for any kind of reason. Maybe it's your partner who has bad sperm at 35. Well, it's been kept, so it's going to be probably less costly to the system than if you use your 35 or 39 year old eggs. You might be successful in one cycle rather than in three. All this, you know, it's a bit far-fetched, but yes, the question of money is very difficult for the time being. We do at UCLH, we do freezing of eggs all the time, all the women who have cancer and all that. We do not do social freezing. And in the current political climate and the threats to the NHS, I cannot see the system saying to all women, okay, come and freeze your eggs between 28 and 32 and we pay for it. So that's, yeah. And London is the most expensive city in Europe, as we know.
Did you want to add a thing as people?
I think practicality in a clinic day to day, whether it is surplus embryos after IVF and whether eggs frozen or sperm frozen, you are told from the outset that you will have to have someone pay, whether it is NHS or yourself, and that payment is for the actual treatment and payment for storage. And most of the time, people will be going into it, their eyes wide open. But in the rare circumstance where a woman doesn't have the money to pay for the continued storage fees, I just can't imagine that anyone will contemplate destroying the eggs or embryos for the sake of money. There must be a way.
Lady over that back.
When would you actually use them? So if you froze your eggs and then you end up in a relationship, at what point would you stop, would you advise somebody not to try and conceive naturally and to use the frozen eggs? Would you always try natural, first? Yeah.
Yes, it's a lot cheaper than IVF.
Yes, always try that. Yeah.
Like any definition of infertility,
exactly.
Definition of infertility nowadays is trying for 1 year with regular sex.
Yeah.
We do not mind, as fertility specialists, to see people over the age of 35. We do not mind if a GP refers them to us after 6 to 8 months, because by the time we've done our investigation and so on, either you're pregnant after 1 year or we have. So like anybody, unless you know already, having done some tests, that you might be running out of eggs, or if your partner has not got good enough sperm, just like anybody else.
Yeah.
Do you wonder whether it might just become a class issue in the future, you know, or have you had your eggs frozen yet?
I think that's a really, really important issue. I didn't have time to mention this, but one of the things that's quite interesting is that although you might have a situation where men and women who want to pursue relatively high status, relatively high income careers, that their positions, if this were to become routine, become a bit equalised. The position of women, depending on their income bracket, the gulf opens up because this is an expensive treatment. It's not available on the NHS. And if you are a low income woman or an unemployed woman, there are no good reasons to delay childbearing in the same way as there are for women who want to pursue careers. So there's already an age difference in when people have their first child, depending on their social background, and that could become even wider if were this, I mean, who knows whether this will ever become something that people do a lot. But I think there's something quite interesting there about possibly some parity between men and women, but at the same time, a chasm in relation to class.
It's interesting because actually what I've found with my friends is that when I tell men that I've had my eggs frozen, they're like, oh, all right, cool, great, eggs, yeah. But when I tell women, it can be more problematic, especially women my own age. And actually when you dig deeper, a lot of the time it's like, well, you're lucky you could afford that, I couldn't. And I didn't actually, my dad paid for my eggs freezing, so I was lucky that I had that. So yeah, I think that is very, even in just the conversations you have, it's like, oh, I can't afford it. But what I will say is, I don't get this. For me personally, the whole like my motivation has never been, oh, I don't want to get knocked up because of my career. It's always been about relationship and these kind of like deeper things. So I don't see that much danger in thinking that people will become complacent or anything like that.
Well, I think that's all that's journey.
Yeah,
you can't predict. You can't predict what would happen in the future in terms of things.
Yeah.
I had read about Apple and Facebook offering it.
You see, I think that's too much. I think that, what that is part of is this thing about shaming women for being fertile. It's actually like a part of a hostility towards women in the workplace becoming mothers. And so I actually think it's really problematic. Like, although it is good, yeah, someone's paying for you to have your eggs frozen, yeah, great. But actually the undertone is, you know, when women want to become mothers, it's kind of like difficult. We want them to be workhorses for longer. And I think that that's like a real big issue and not what women are making their decisions based on.
Can I just say something really quickly? Just Helen's absolutely right about the reasons why women are doing it. I think something really interesting about the, because obviously there's quite small scale studies that are being done so far, because this is a relatively new thing. But the reasons women are giving are not career related. People aren't saying my workplace is insufficiently flexible. It's all to do with relationships and perhaps not having a suitable partner, or having a partner who's not ready, doesn't feel ready. So it may be that there were decisions that were taken back in their early 20s that women took about not, you know, not having a baby when they were much, much younger. But it, honestly, it's not, the reasons women given are not career related, it's partner related.
And actually I feel that the kind of work environment and the social, the dating environment is hostile to the idea that motherhood is really important to you, right? So it's kind of this like interesting thing where they're offering you like egg freezing, but it's part of this kind of thing of like, oh, women in their 30s are really unattractive to like employers, men, because they want to have babies. And there's like not, this is the social problem. There's not this kind of like support for building relationships and family. And that's what needs to happen, I think.
So yeah,
sorry. There's a lady at the back with a question.
At what stage during the process of egg freezing would you know whether your eggs were successful, would be successful when you fertilize them? And what are your chances of success? I mean, it was partly answered, but I just want a more detailed answer.
I think you get some information from the process. If you are doing the egg freezing for someone who is 28 and produce 20 eggs, and then you remove the covering layer of cells from the egg to assess maturity, and you ended up with, say, 18 mature eggs that you will freeze, certainly everything seemed to be promising a good prognosis. But on the other hand, if you are doing it because a patient knows the facts and would like to do it at the age of 38, and you got 8 eggs, and by the time you looked at them, you find 6 mature, then the odds are not as much. That is as far as it goes.
And I also maybe just wanted to touch on maybe what thoughts are in terms of travelling to do this egg freezing. If you're saying in other countries there aren't those statutory laws in terms of the length you can keep them, how would you advise people as clinicians and, you know, just people with experience in that as well?
Well, this is the work which I'm just right now doing with our urban society. Many people go to Spain because of their experience. Some people go to the Czech Republic who also have some experience. On the other hand, the country where I was born, I'm sure you've heard the French accent, forbids by law non-medical freezing, because the French law says we will only offer assisted reproduction to a couple, no single women as well, who have infertility. So my colleagues in France, they're not sure whether they slightly bend the law or not, but they refer people to the UK and to Spain, and one of my colleagues said also referred to the Czech Republic. So there are movements on both sides, and it's on all the website, you know, come to Barcelona or wherever, and then, you know, one phone call away, or what, they'll give you the price and everything. So yes, it is a bit like being a consumer, which I don't like, being a fertility specialist.
Okay, we'll have one last question on the front row, and then we'll...
So what is the criteria then for setting up one of these clinics? Like, how do we know, you know, you were saying that you should ask for statistics to determine what's a good clinic, but can anyone open a clinic? And what is the variability between clinics in Spain and clinics here in the UK or clinics in, say, Canada?
So we've not heard the question at the back. Yeah. So what's the variability between clinics in the UK and elsewhere, and how can you judge what is a good clinic?
Which is very easy to answer.
Because we're lucky to have the Human Fertilization and the Virology Authority. They have criteria. They are expected for any medical establishment to satisfy in order to be entitled or licensed to provide this treatment, whether it is treatment, storage, or research. So within this, the HFA will be providing information, and there is a huge project currently called Information for Quality that I'm sure will improve the information provided about particular treatment and about results from different centers, and that could help guide. It may not be perfect yet, but certainly it is improving to enable choice.
Is that just in the UK, though?
Yes.
European research hat is that most countries in Europe will have a similar body. There's a few, and you know the line will be more towards Eastern Europe rather than Western and Central, where there's no legislation, but most countries in Europe are very well legislated. It's different in the US, where there is no federal legislation. There is the American Society, who's supposed to oversee it all, but I suppose you might have a few rogue, I don't know. Canada, I'm not sure, because there's also a body like the HFEA, and I think they're pretty well regulated as well.
So it's one of the dangers of going abroad, to go back to your question, is that in the UK, one of the conditions of a clinic having a license is there have to be all sorts of things in place. Say the clinic goes out of business, what happens to the eggs? What happens if something goes wrong? Are there mechanisms in place to ensure that nothing does go wrong? So that would all happen in the UK. One of the things, if you do go abroad, you need to be very careful about is there a similar standard of regulation? Yeah. And there are obviously, as Francois said, in other European countries, very high standards of regulation.
Indeed, and so
there are some countries where...
Well, to win private, I would say, well, maybe you should go as well. So, but I will only speak in the presence of a lawyer.
So I'd like to everyone to thank the panel, Francois, Helen, Matthew, very much.
Listen to all of our talks and find out more information at time-less.org.